sniper was turned, I don't know. But it creates more questions than it answers, and that makes me nervous.
Me too, said the general. How about you, Stan?
After shoving the photocopy of the kidnapper's note back into his folder, Director Jameson began massaging his temples.
Yeah, I'm nervous. The neatness of some of it is what scares me. I'm beginning to think tonight might not be such a good idea.
What might not be such a good idea? Asked Harvath.
The FBI trace on that phone call today locked up. We got a fix on the location of the caller, but God help us if this is wrong, said the director.
I don't understand, said Harvath.
The general took a deep breath. Vice President Marshfield, in accordance with the United States position of no negotiating with terrorists, has green-lighted a special ops team to attempt a rescue. We're on our way to the Situation Room at the White House. The mission will launch in less than 2 hours.
But they couldn't have possibly gathered enough intel yet. They have no idea what that team will be walking into, said Harvath.
That's exactly what we're afraid of, said the general. Aren't we, Stan?
30.
The White House Situation Room buzzed with noise, most of which came from Vice President Marshfield's chief of staff, Edward DeFina. The VP had wasted no time moving himself and his people into the power positions in the White House, and DeFina had bullied anyone who resisted or resented the changing of the guard. He was a perfect example of a man who sought power solely to lord it over others. Because of his background and top-secret clearance, Harvath had been invited to attend a comprehensive tactical briefing with the general. He spent 2 hours listening to the general and his staff discuss the makeup of the JSOC team and the reliability of their intelligence. The insertion and extraction methods were reviewed, and as the team would be supported by Israeli intelligence, the makeup and components on that end were gone over as well. Several recent security and communications enhancements at the White House made it possible to use the Situation Room as a command and control center for the mission. Using the SIT room, as it was known, meant that not only could the vice president preside at the head of the table in the high-backed leather chair reserved for the president, but all of the players would come to him. The idea of getting the Washington establishment used to seeing him in power greatly appealed to Marshfield's ego, and so he was adamant that the main command center for observing the operation be the White House. The directors of the FBI, CIA, and Secret Service had grudgingly agreed, only with the caveat that NSA and CIA headquarters be kept available on open lines. If the satellite picture went down, the consensus among those truly in the know was that the White House's redundant backup systems were not entirely fail-safe and might not be something to count upon. As Harvath entered the sit room behind General Venrick, he quickly glanced around, assessing those assembled. The aforementioned directors of the various agencies were present, accompanied by their aides. JSOC brass, who hadn't shuttled to the Mediterranean to be on site, were in attendance. Harvath was well acquainted with several of those present, and he nodded in their direction as he caught their eyes. There were also other military and governmental personnel present whom no one bothered to introduce. Scanning the long cherry wood table, Harvath saw Gary Lawler, and at first thought the comment that rang out from that end of the room had come from him.
What the hell is he doing here? Asked the voice.
As Scott focused upon a group of people who were not seated, General Venrick said,
I believe Agent Harvath can be of service to us in this operation, and I have asked him to join us.
From what I hear, the only person Agent Harvath seems to be of service to is himself, that is, when he's not being of service to CNN. And he was considered such an impediment that our own deputy director of the FBI had to have him removed from the case.
The man stepped away from the group and leaned on the far end of the table. Scott could see him clearly now, Edward DeFina.
Director Jameson piped up before anyone had a chance to respond. It was obvious that there was no love lost between the two.
That is still under investigation, DeFina, and you know it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Secret Service did succeed in losing the president, didn't it? I mean, that's why we're all here, right?
Scott had never been one to let others fight his own battles.
Chief of Staff DeFina, I personally knew every single one of the Secret Service agents who died trying to protect the President and his daughter. As a matter of fact, from what I saw in Park City, had I not been retasked to Goldilocks' detail, there's probably no doubt she and I would be among the dead as well. So considering that you have absolutely zero idea of what the Secret Service has been through and what we go through on a daily basis, I suggest you get to the point, if you have one.
Gary Lawler shook his head and began to massage his eyes with his thumb and forefinger. He hadn't been able to believe it when Harvath arrived with General Venrick and the Secret Service director. The kid had as many lives as a cat. Somehow, somewhere, someone had decided to cut him some more slack. But once again, he was quickly hanging himself with it. Lawler was still upset about what had transpired in Park City and was not going to stick his neck out to help defend the headstrong Secret Service agent anymore. Harvath was completely on his own as far as Lawler was concerned.
"My point, Agent Harvath," said DeFina, warming to the challenge, "is that you and your agency were charged with a task, and you failed. Failed miserably, I might add. To compound the damage, you tampered with no less than 3 related crime scenes, and, until I am convinced otherwise, leaked sensitive information to the press. That is my point."
"This is a bunch of bullshit," said the general.
Anyone who had sheepishly been listening to the exchange, pretending not to hear it, now turned his or her eyes toward the man who had drawn himself to his full height.
"None of this has any bearing on why we're all here. We have asked Agent Harvath to come along because of his vast anti-terrorist experience, and in the hopes that as one of the sole survivors of the kidnapping, he might be able to help us shed more light on what we are facing and what we will do going forward."
"Going forward?" asked DeFina. "General, you don't sound as if you believe this operation tonight will be successful. Why is that?"
"Why is that? It's because we haven't had sufficient time to gather the appropriate intelligence to mount an effective recovery."
"General, when this whole thing blew, were you or were you not involved in our strategic assessment meeting?"
"I was, but..."
"General, you were the one person who advocated moving as fast as we could, as soon as we had reliable information to act upon."
"Mr. DeFina, that's the last time you are going to interrupt me. As far as what I said, you seem to have ignored the fact that the word I used was reliable."
Unfazed, DeFina continued.
"General Venrick, I don't know how much more specific you need your information to be. One of the kidnappers, a freelance Middle Eastern sniper who often worked for the pro-Palestinian liberation groups, was found dead at the scene. We received proof that some organization does indeed have the president, and then they asked for the release of 2 Islamic terrorists with suspected FRC connections who were being held in this country. When their ransom demand was phoned into the FBI, we were able to pinpoint where it came from. What more do you need?"
"What more does he need?" interjected Harvath. "For starters, how about intelligence that the phone that was used is actually in the same location the president is being held?"
"Agent Harvath," said DeFina, "I don't really care for your opinion, but I'll answer you anyway. The Israeli Mossad has assets throughout Lebanon, and in particular the area we're concentrating on. The Syrian government also has its sources."
"The Syrians?"
It was now the CIA director's chance to interject.
"You contacted the Syrians without consulting with my office first?"
"First of all, Director Vail, it was Vice President Marshfield who contacted the Syrian president. And secondly, I hardly think..."
"No kidding," said Harvath.
DeFina glared at Harvath, and the CIA director took the opportunity to continue his attack.
"You have absolutely no idea what you are doing. This whole operation may have been compromised."
"Director Vail, the Vice President and I are confident that the participation of the Syrians and the Israelis can only help this endeavor."
"Jesus," said Harvath. "That's it, isn't it? Not only will the Vice President look good if he can get the President back, but a U.S.-Israeli operation that involves the Syrians could go a long way on the world stage in helping to begin mending their fences. You and Marshfield are going to squeeze as much political juice out of this thing as you can."
"Agent Harvath, you are way out of line," barked DeFina.
"Am I? I don't think there's a person in this room who isn't well aware that the president seriously doubts whether he will run for a second term. This whole thing stinks. This is a half-assed game to you, and you're asking good men to put their lives on the line for it.
Agent Harvath, you sound as if you don't want the president to be recovered, continued Dafina.
What I want is for the president to be recovered, but with no further American lives lost in the process.
A commendable goal that I think we can all agree with. Good evening, all, said Vice President Marshfield as he strutted in. A chorus of good evening, Mr. Vice President, rang throughout the sit room. The assembled men and women took their places around the table, and as expected, the Vice President sat at the head in the chair that had always been reserved for the President himself.
Gentlemen, the Vice President began, I know we are on a tight schedule, so I think it's best if we turn this over right away to General Venrick, commander of the Joint Special Operations Command. General?
The General stood.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. As you all know, the intelligence we've been able to gather thus far indicates that the President was taken hostage by the Abu Nidal organization, the Fatah RC, to be ransomed in exchange for Egypt's unfreezing certain assets and the return of the Disneyland bombers. Our attempts at gaining further intel as to the health and well-being of Abu Nidal, the group's supposed leader, have been unsuccessful. What we do know is that the call the FBI received from the kidnappers was traced to a building south of Beirut, outside the town of Saida, or Sidon, as it is better known, on the Lebanese coast of the Mediterranean Sea. According to intelligence provided by the Israelis, this building is believed to be tied to the FRC organization, though further information than that is not available, which is troubling.
Troubling? Said the Vice President, raising his eyebrows, his hands crossed in front of him.
Yes, sir, continued General Venrick. The only surveillance of the building we've been able to run is via satellite, which took us longer than we would have liked due to retasking and getting it into an alternate orbit. While the Mossad does have assets in and around Sidon, there has not been proper time to conduct full-fledged surveillance.
Correct me if I'm wrong, General, but you were the one who said we needed to strike fast if we were to have any chance of getting the President back, said the Vice President.
Chief of Staff Dafina leaned back in his chair with a smug look of satisfaction and stared at the General, daring him to defy the Vice President.
Yes, sir, I did say that, but are you having second thoughts, General?
I am sure you would agree with me that this is a time for action and not indecision, said the Vice President.
I do agree, sir, but going off half-cocked can result in the loss of not only lives on our recovery team, but also the President's, if he is actually in that building.
You have doubts as to whether the President is actually there?
Why didn't you bring these to my attention earlier? Said the Vice President,
knowing full well why the General had not been able to communicate his concerns.
Mr. Vice President, I tried to contact you several times, but Chief of Staff Dafina told me you were busy and that he would have you get back to me.
Marshfield looked at Dafina. Is this true?
Feigning contrition, Dafina said, Mr. Vice President, the past 48 hours have been absolute turmoil for all of us. If the General was having trouble getting through, I don't know why he didn't come to the White House to share these feelings with you in person.
Incredulous, the General answered, Number one, I figured if I couldn't get him on the phone, I certainly wasn't going to be able to see him here, and number two, I had an operation to assemble.
Turning his attention back to the Vice President, he continued,
Sir, even with our most sophisticated technology, the building in question has not offered even the slightest clue as to who or what might be inside.
And this troubles you because? Asked the Vice President.
It troubles me because our men will be going in blind. They don't know how many terrorists are inside or where the President is being kept, if he's there at all.
Are we going to go through this again? Asked Dafina, pretending to be exasperated.
The Vice President silenced Dafina with a wave of his hand.
General, do you have any information that suggests that the President is not being held at this location?
No, sir. But by the same token, we don't have enough to suggest that he is either.
After lengthy discussion with my staff as well as Agent Harvath.
Agent Harvath? Asked the Vice President. Is he now a member of the Joint Special Operations Command?
No, sir, but his past experience in counterterrorism and JSOC-coordinated operations, I think more than qualifies him to...
The Vice President raised his hand, this time indicating that he wished for the General to be silent.
Agent Harvath, do you have something you wish to add to this? Because I'm sure we would all be very interested to hear it, considering everything that has happened already.
Ignoring the Vice President's sarcasm, Harvath stood as the General retook his seat.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I have to admit that I am in agreement with the General.
And why is that?
There are a lot of pieces in this puzzle that don't make sense. We think we are making progress when the truth is the kidnappers are three steps ahead of us. They have anticipated every move we make and are ready for it. With the level of sophistication we have seen on their part, I find it suspicious that they allowed the ransom call to be traced.
Lawler's head tilted almost imperceptibly to the left as he pondered the implications of what Harvath had just said.
And you enlightened General Venrick with your wisdom? Asked the Vice President.
Everything except my opinion about the trace.
Not wanting to admit that his constant headache might be affecting his judgment, Scott offered his excuse for not having come up with this insight earlier.
It wasn't until I arrived here that this piece of information fell into place. It just doesn't feel right.
Doesn't feel right. You want me to forego maybe the only chance we have to get the President back because it doesn't feel right?
Agent Harvath, despite your feelings, do we have any information that indicates the President is anywhere else?
No, sir.
And have you thought about what kind of situation we might be in if we pass up this chance tonight, and the President is moved tomorrow to another location from which the kidnappers do not make any further phone calls that can be traced?
No, sir.
And even if the recovery team does not find the President at this location tonight, have you thought about the intelligence we might be able to gather if we are able to take into custody any operatives of the Fatah organization who might have some connection to the kidnapping?
No, sir, said Harvath for the third time.
He could see exactly where the Vice President was going with his reasoning. It was drastically flawed, but as he was the acting commander-in-chief, there was no way he could be overridden, no matter how many holes there were in his plan. The deck had been stacked against Harvath and General Venrick, but it had been used to make a house of cards. It wouldn't take much to topple it, but by that time, it would be too late.
Agent Harvath, as far as I can tell, you have not thought this mission and its consequences out in their entirety.
We proceed as planned, ordered the Vice President.
Choking on a response that would only have gotten him in deeper trouble and surely thrown out of the sit room, Scott sat back down. He reached for the carafe in front of him, poured a glass of water, and popped two more Tylenols. This was going to be a very long night.
31. So far, the JSOC mission was going according to plan. The recovery team rendezvoused with a small fishing boat off the coast of Israel just after 2 a.m. The contingent of Navy SEALs had been tasked to enforce a NATO blockade in the Persian Gulf. Since speed was of the essence for this mission, codenamed Rapid Return, they were the best qualified and most readily available choice for the recovery. The dark, humid air hung over the South Lebanese coast like a wet blanket. It was stifling, yet the team members paid no attention to the heat. Their minds were focused on their assignment and the role each would need to play for it to be successful. Back in Washington, D.C., safely tucked away in the White House sit room, Scott Harvath knew exactly what the SEALs on that small fishing boat were feeling. Out of habit, his pulse picked up, and the adrenaline began to surge as a quiet communication was relayed via satellite halfway around the world through the recessed speakers of the sit room.
"Jonah, this is Ishmael. No bites. We're headed in," said the voice of the SEAL team leader.
"Nothing on the nets, either. Hope you land a big one. Happy fishing," came the response from the JSOC command center.
Even though General Venrick wore a headset that kept him continuously in the loop,
He had been furious that the vice president had insisted he watch the operation from the sit room. The general trusted his people at JSOC command, but when it came right down to it, he was in charge, and should have been there, rather than in the sit room, as if it were a skybox at a Redskins game. The general had explained the codes and call signs to Harvath as they waited for the mission to begin. With that information, Scott was able to translate the exchange he was hearing. Harvath knew from experience that anywhere from 100 to 200 yards out, depending on the conditions, the team would slide over the sides of their inflatable and into the water. Unsheathing their knives, team members would rip holes in the craft, and its heavy outboard engine would pull it straight to the bottom. Before any wreckage could possibly be discovered, the team would be long gone. All eyes were glued to a series of monitors, strategically interspersed across the front of the sit room. There were also individual monitors recessed at each setting in the table. Internal JSOC communications from the command center drifted down from the overhead speakers. The constant narrative relayed data on the mission's progress and would be automatically interrupted any time a member of Rapid Return's recovery force broke radio silence. Glancing around the room, Scott noticed that both the general and CIA Director Vail had laptops plugged into the White House's secure communication links. Undoubtedly, each was keeping in touch with their respective offices through private means as well. A very smart idea. Harvath peered at the screens in the front of the room. They were considerably bigger than the monitor recessed within the table in front of him. Even though he could switch from picture to picture from where he sat, he preferred the wider panorama up front. Each of the SEALs was outfitted with a fiber optic night vision wide-angle lens camera that relayed back exactly what was in their field of view. The largest of the monitors was a flat panel device showing images collected by an NSA spy satellite network known as Chaperone. Chaperone was a highly sophisticated reconnaissance system designed to gather intelligence and assist in clandestine operations occurring predominantly at night. Chaperone incorporated night vision capabilities unrivaled by any other intelligence-gathering system in existence. As it utilized several overlapping satellites, loitering time over a target had been greatly increased from times past. The main flat-paneled screen at the front of the room provided a picture-in-picture view. The largest and most prominent image was of the beach that the SEAL team was swimming toward. In the lower right-hand corner of the screen was the satellite image of what Harvath assumed was the primary objective, the FRC compound. When the SEALs made land, they had just under a mile run inland, where a truck and two drivers would be waiting for them. Secreted in the back of the truck, the special ops team would be driven to within a few blocks of their target. No one in the room spoke. The chatter of the JSOC command center and intermittent beeps, presumably from satellites, had an eerie NASA quality to it all, as if the group were waiting for a fragile capsule to return from the dark side of the moon and report in. Scott realized that there was nothing that could be said at a moment like this. Besides, the general was still in charge, and things needed to be kept absolutely quiet so he could work. He had insisted that was the one condition he would not compromise on if he was going to be at the sit room instead of JSOC command when Rapid Return went into action. The minutes seemed like hours as the SEAL team made their way inland toward the truck. A monitor in the upper right corner of the room showed a live picture of JSOC command. Harvath's analogy of a NASA mission hadn't been far off the mark. JSOC command looked very similar to what he had seen of Mission Control in Texas. JSOC operatives sat at long rows of computer terminals that tiered like amphitheater steps as they rose upward from the many screens covering the wall in front of them. Knowing the military's penchant for organization, Harvath assumed that the operatives would be grouped according to their skills, such as communications and satellite technology, with the most important operatives being placed in the very back near the top brass. Each member of the SEAL team wore a special set of wide-view night vision goggles. Recently developed for special operations forces, the goggles not only improved the soldier's field and depth of vision, but also allowed for a small computer screen to be toggled on and off in a pre-selected part of the goggles. On that screen, a team leader
could see whatever any of his men were seeing via the fiber optic camera attached to the top of the goggles. And it also allowed team members to view any information that their commanders wanted them to see, such as directional maps or the images coming off the chaperone network. Harvath stared at the intent faces of the SEALs, shown in night vision green via the cameras of their fellow soldiers sitting across from them in the truck. The detail in the pictures was astounding. The technology Scott had used as an active SEAL had been mind-boggling, but in the short amount of time he had been out, it had morphed to such an advanced degree, he almost couldn't believe it. The narrative voice from JSOC Command could be heard in the sit room once again, and everyone leaned forward into the table. 1 minute to delivery, said the voice. The small picture-in-picture on Chaperone's screen grew, dwarfing the other as the rapid return team entered an area close enough to the objective that everything could be seen on one screen. Entering a street of decaying buildings, flanked by the ever-encroaching desert, the truck slowed. Having used Chaperone to try to scan the immediate area for any potential hostile targets, JSOC Command queried Israeli intelligence as to their ground assets posted at both ends of the street. The word came back, all clear, and JSOC hailed the SEAL leader. Jonah, this is Ishmael. Time to enter the whale. Over.
Enter the whale. Roger. Jonah out, came the response.
The team leader gave the go command. One by one, the SEALs jumped from the truck, rolled when they hit the ground, and immediately took cover. Except for the sound of the rapidly receding truck, the street was completely silent. Knowing that police and civil defense patrols were on sporadic and unreliable schedules, the recovery team did a quick check of their equipment and moved out. Each member of the team had memorized the satellite reconnaissance photos that showed their delivery point, objective, the extraction point, and two backup possibilities that would be used only if needed. Their silenced MP-10s at the ready, Rapid Return's recovery team picked their way through the rubble-strewn alley in front of them and headed east toward their objective. Advancing cautiously, the team froze sporadically at sounds coming from the windows above. Even though the men were disguised in the robes and headdresses of poor villagers, if any local got a good look at the heavily outfitted assault team, the alarm would surely be raised. Dangerously close to the objective, the team, as planned, ready to split up. Although the Israelis had cross-trained with the SEALs in the past, General Venrick had insisted they be on-site only for reconnaissance and support if needed. The actual assault would be carried out by Rapid Return's American recovery team.
Ishmael, this is Jonah. We are ready to enter the whale. Can you give us a sit rep? Over.
Roger, Jonah. Chaperone shows you are all clear.
Too clear, Harvath thought, as he looked at the screen in front of him.
If the FRC was hiding the president in this location, it would be much more heavily guarded. Maybe, though, the FRC thought posting guards would attract too much attention. What was odd was that U.S. satellites had been able to show people coming in and out of the FRC building, but had not been able to penetrate to see inside. These mud and brick houses were nothing for the NSA's peekaboo technology, but the target building had been shielded with some sort of protective material, impervious to all the NSA's gadgetry. As if reading Harvath's thoughts, General Venrick spoke into his lip mic.
Jonah, this is the old man. Are you in a position to ascertain the nature of the whale's skin?
The fact that the satellite hadn't been able to penetrate the building had bothered Venrick as well. Speaking quietly into his throat mic, the team leader responded,
Negative. It looks the same as all the others.
Checking Chaperone one last time, the general responded,
Jonah, you may cast your bread upon the waters. Over.
Roger that. Jonah out.
With a flick of his fingers, the team leader sent two members scurrying around the back of the houses toward the rear of the target building. Two more were sent to the home just adjacent. Moving quickly and using the shadows for cover as much as possible, the remaining four members of the squad headed toward the ugly crimson-colored door of a house just down the street from the target building. As arranged by the Israelis, the door was unlocked. Weapons ready,
the team entered the house, sweeping the first and then the second floors. Satisfied that it was clean, they carefully made their way to the roof. Slowly, the team leader raised the trapdoor and peered out. Confident there was no immediate danger, he took off his goggles and took a pair of more powerful night vision binoculars from his pack. From what he could see, everything was quiet. He slid from underneath the hatch and crawled along the roof to its southeast corner. So as not to give himself away, he balanced his goggles on the parapet wall of the roof and aimed them toward the objective. The team's second in command toggled to the leader's vision screen and, not seeing anything in the vicinity of the objective, flashed the leader a thumbs up. The man known as Jonah retrieved his goggles, crept forward toward the corner of the roof, and gently raised himself to look over the parapet wall with his binoculars. The objective was perfectly quiet, not even anyone on its roof. These Fatah guys were either very confident or very stupid. Crawling back to the trapdoor, Jonah put his night vision goggles back on before signaling the team sniper that it was all clear. Squeezing through the tight opening, the muscular and deadly accurate 25-year-old rolled onto the roof and prepped his weapon. He carried a silenced Walther WA-2000 sniping rifle, which fired a 300 Winchester Magnum cartridge. Even without its loopholed night vision scope and laser rangefinder, there wasn't much the sniper couldn't hit. With the specially designed barrel clamped at the front and rear, the torque from the large bullet wouldn't lift it away from its intended target. The barrel had also been fluted, further reducing the gun's vibrations on firing. With its pistol-style grip and customized butt and cheek pads, this weapon would do very nicely if anybody chose to come snooping around while Operation Rapid Return was in progress. Jonah and his two remaining team members were to make the frontal assault. Exiting the house where they'd left their sniper, the men picked their way down the deserted street, breathing a little easier, knowing they were under the watchful and protective eyes of one of the best long guns the SEALs had ever trained. The key elements of the mission were speed, surprise, and overwhelming force. As Jonah and his men neared the target building, all of its shutters were drawn. Adjusting the fine tuning on his goggles, Jonah looked up toward the flat roof and noticed that there were indeed sheets of what looked like lead protruding along the edges, covered with plaster and mud. Confident that the right people back in D.C. had seen what he had and knew what it was, he and his men carefully scanned the perimeter. There were no signs of any intrusion devices, not even dogs.
"Ishmael, this is Jonah," he whispered, his throat mic perfectly picking up every word. "It is very quiet. Do you detect any motion?"
"Negative, Jonah. You are all clear. Proceed when ready." By means of the arched courtyard, two rapid return members were able to scale the common wall to reach the adjoining roof next door undetected. Resisting the urge to make a joke about what a great haircut he would give the two team members who had just climbed upon the roof, the sniper kept his communication to the bare minimum and said into his throat mic,
"Alpha, this is Watchdog. I have you in my sights, and you are all clear."
"Affirmative," responded Alpha's leader.
Hearing that Alpha was on the next roof, Jonah said into his throat mic,
"Alpha, the whale skin may be tougher than we thought. Get over and check it out. I want an assessment ASAP."
"Roger," came Alpha's response. Quietly, the two men picked their way across the roof of the adjoining house, wary of weak spots, thanks to a training story of an operative who fell through a roof in Panama. Jonah and his team members stayed concealed in the shadows just down from the front of the target building as the other team waited behind it. Finally, Alpha checked back in.
"Jonah, this is Alpha. It looks like the roof entry is metal, pretty thick, but the hinges are on the outside. With a little bit of give glue, I think we can breach it."
Give glue referred to the small tubes of specially formulated acid paste that the teams carried with them on missions where doors would need to be breached and hinges couldn't simply be blown away. Once applied, it ate through almost any type of metal in only a matter of seconds.
"Hold on, Alpha," said Jonah.
"Bravo,
are you in position?"
"Roger, good to go," came the voice of the Bravo leader.
"Okay then, Alpha. Start the glue, and let us know when you're ready, said Jonah.
Creeping beneath the windows of the house, Jonah and his men made their way to the old wooden front door. As he'd figured, it was locked, but it would be nothing for them.
Watchdog, you got the door in case they don't like Avon calling?
Asked Jonah.
Knock, knock, motherfucker. Just like when we did Gaddafi. I've got you covered, replied Watchdog.
Alpha, how are we doing?
Almost there.
Good, listen up. Just as we planned, fast and furious. Flashbangs first. Does everyone copy?
Bravo, roger.
Alpha, roger. And it looks like we're ready to crash the party. On your command, Jonah. Over.
The men in the sit room held their breath.
Okay. On my command. Firemen, take your positions. Pitchers, ready your flashbangs. We go in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now!
In sync, Jonah's men breached their respective entry points, tossed in their flashbangs, and quickly followed once the concussions had detonated. What Rapid Return's recovery team never had a chance to see was the white-hot blaze that moments later appeared on Chaperone's screen as the entire street and the house they had entered were reduced to dust. The SEALs, including their sniper, never saw it coming. 32. At the same moment Chaperone showed the building exploding, the night vision images from the SEAL battle cams disappeared and were replaced on each monitor with a chilling two-word message. Offline. The shock and silence in the sit room were quickly replaced by a frenzy of activity. Glancing up at the monitor that fed a live picture from JSOC Command, Harvath noticed it was chaotic there as well. Every phone in the sit room was being used by people trying to figure out what had happened. Scott was closest to General Venrick, and he listened as Venrick tried to get a handle on things.
We were able to figure that out from here. It looks like it was a very big one, at least 1 to 2 square blocks from what Chaperone is showing us right now.
First things first, can we confirm the status of the Rapid Return team?
What about the Israeli assets on site?
My God, only one?
Have him get in there and get a better look.
We have got to get confirmation. If there are injured men there, we need to get them out.
I agree. We began to worry about it as well, but it's a little late for that now.
All right. Get on the Israelis and get back to me as soon as you get an update. In the meantime, I want you to roll back the tape on the battle cams to 1 minute before they went offline and feed it back here in slow-mo.
Negative. Until we know what the situation is, all teams are to stand by. That's it. Get going.
The general shook his head in disgust, feeling he should have pressed the vice president harder to postpone the recovery attempt until they had gathered more intelligence. Instead, a crack SEAL team had walked right into a trap. His increased dislike of the vice president was surpassed only by the shame he felt in losing men under his command. This had been a half-baked idea from the start, and he should have stopped it. As JSOC Command fed back the battle cam images in slow-mo, the general used his comlink to give orders to freeze-frame certain images and rewind others. A team of military experts, aided by the ATF, would be poring over these pictures for months, ascertaining whether there was one blast or several, where the blast or blasts originated, as well as what type of explosive device was used. But for now, the general needed to put together his own picture of what had happened. The images showed that each of the assault teams was able to successfully breach its entry point and pitch in its flashbangs, hoping to stun any immediate targets with the blinding white light and concussion tremors they emitted. After the teams entered, the battle cam showed that they moved quickly and began to secure the rooms on their respective levels. The cam showed what appeared to be sleeping men in some of the rooms, but would the kidnappers actually booby-trap themselves? Before any of the men could be secured with the plastic riot cuffs that the teams always carried, there was a bright flash and the cams went offline. Because of the need for his vision to be unimpaired while he looked through the night vision scope on his rifle,
The sniper's battle cam wasn't of much help. His goggles had been placed on top of his pack, off to his left-hand side. His images lasted for only a few frames more than those of his teammates, who presumably were at the epicenter of the explosion. Whatever had been used was extremely powerful. Chances were low to absolutely non-existent that any of the team had survived. In the midst of the chaos, no one noticed that the president's direct line rang and that the vice president's chief of staff had answered it until he cupped the mouthpiece and screamed for everyone to quiet down. The entire room was taken aback. His face was ashen.
"How did you get this number?" Dafina asked.
Lawler knew exactly who was on the phone and was the first one to react. He picked up the phone in front of him and dialed faster than he ever had in his life. When a voice answered on the other end, he gave his name, password, and location. He gave the orders to begin a trace and was floored by the response. "No can do."
"What?"
Lawler hissed into the phone.
"You've got to be kidding me. This is a matter of national security. Now trace the damn call."
Lawler's boss, FBI Director Source, put a hand on his arm and whispered, "Gary, they can't trace any calls coming or going from the sit room. It's impossible."
"What do you mean, impossible?" he asked.
When the room and equipment were updated, so were the communications. The lines had to be tap and trace proof. Besides, who would have ever envisioned a scenario like this where a trace would be necessary? Lawler felt impotent. All he could do was sit and watch. The worst of it was that Dafina was doing all of the talking.
"He wants me to put him on speakerphone. How do I do that?"
Dafina asked, once again cupping the mouthpiece. Two button punches later, and the cyborg-style voice that Lawler remembered all too well clicked out of the overhead speakers.
"Good evening, gentlemen," the voice said.
Since the kidnappers had originally established contact with Lawler, no one objected as he rose from his seat to walk over to the active phone. As he rounded the table, Vice President Marshfield held up a hand, stopping him in his tracks. Lawler was stunned. The voice continued.
"I trust your vice president is present?"
Dafina slid the phone toward him.
"Yes, I am here. Who is this?"
"More silly games," said the voice.
"You know exactly who this is. Did you enjoy our little demonstration?"
"What are you talking about?"
"Mr. Vice President, I will say this only once. Do not play games with me."
"Where is the president?"
"He is quite comfortable, I assure you."
"How can we be sure?"
"Mr. Vice President, we have already proven that we have him, and that we are capable of outthinking you and your military. The explosion was quite an unfortunate but necessary occurrence. So many souls called to Allah, unwitting of the role they have played in the jihad."
"Is that what this is all about? Some kind of holy war?"
"I commend you, Mr. Vice President. Your knowledge of foreign affairs is greater than your critics give you credit for."
The insult raised the hairs on the back of the vice president's neck. Inwardly, almost every member in the sit room would have congratulated the kidnapper for that jibe if he hadn't been behind so much death and mayhem.
"You will not get away with this, I guarantee you," said the vice president.
"But I already have."
"What do you want?"
"First, I want to be treated with some respect for my intelligence. Did you actually think I would not know when I called the FBI that they would start an immediate trace? Do you think after all of my careful planning, I would allow this dance to be so quickly brought to an end? By underestimating me, you may be forced to pay the price twice."
"Twice?" said the vice president. "What do you mean, twice?"
"By now, you should be very well aware that your men did not survive the explosion we set. That was the first price. If we were able to slay any of the Israeli pigs that might have been working with the USA in their feeble rescue attempt, then all the better. But the second price will come if you do not cooperate. Evidence will be produced that will link this explosion back to you and the unrecognized state of Israel. it will be seen as an act of U.S.-supported Israeli terrorism against the Palestinian people.
All eyes in the room were upon the vice president. Whatever evidence you might fabricate, it will never work.
Just as a plot to kidnap your president would never work? Tisk, tisk, Mr. Vice President. I believe you are still underestimating me.
You know, Mr. If it is Mr., I don't even know your name, said the Vice President.
My name is not important. What is important are my demands. I want my men released immediately.
It is the policy of the United States government not to negotiate with terrorists.
Is it really? Is this the same no-negotiation policy that was in effect during your arms for hostages fiasco with Iran?
Asked the voice. That was then, and this is now. We absolutely do not negotiate with terrorists. The two men you want killed scores of innocent Americans.
In our opinion, Mr. Vice President, there is no such thing as an innocent American. And further, how many innocent people have been killed throughout the Middle East as a result of the meddling of the United States?
Several people at the table were motioning for the Vice President to shut up and discontinue his hard line with the kidnappers, but he ignored them. I'll make you a deal, said the Vice President, pausing for effect.
A deal? You are in no position to make demands of us. It is we who have your president, and it is we who will make the demands of you. As your show of good faith, you will release our men as we have requested, and you will convince Egypt to unfreeze our assets. You will do this immediately, said the voice.
And then the line went dead. Lawler leaned over to his boss. Hell of a negotiator. Where'd this asshole learn his technique? The FBI director didn't answer. He knew everyone else in the room was thinking the exact same thing. The vice president was completely out of his league. 33. After the meeting in the sit room was adjourned, everyone quietly filed out, still in shock. They were horrified, not only by the failure of rapid return and the loss of top-rate operatives, but also by the way the vice president had handled the kidnapper's phone call. Director Jameson gave Scott a subtle cue to hang back with him. In a few moments, the only other people still sitting at the table were the directors of the FBI and CIA, along with Gary Lawler.
It looks like your instincts were right, said the CIA director to Harvath.
It didn't do those men much good, though, replied Scott.
What could you have done?
I've asked myself that a million times. Not only about tonight, but Sunday, too. These guys, whoever they are, really know what they're doing.
What I want to know, said Lawler, is how the hell they got my direct line, as well as the president's here in the sit room.
As the lock on the soundproof door of the sit room clicked and was followed by the hiss of it swinging open, the men fell silent.
Don't you men have work to do?
Asked Chief of Staff Defina, as he walked across the room to retrieve a file he had left on the table. Vale beat the others to the punch.
You know what, Defina? What we're doing and how we're doing it is none of your goddamn business.
Harvath was taken by surprise. Director Vale had a reputation for being unfailingly diplomatic. Both Defina and his boss, the vice president, rubbed even the calmest of people the wrong way.
I'm sure the vice president wouldn't see it that way, replied a defensive Defina.
Defina was all hot air, a bully. The minute someone stood up to him, he hid behind the vice president's skirts. Harvath let out an audible sigh of contempt, and Defina turned on him.
And you? I wasn't finished with you, Harvath, he said, turning his gaze toward Secret Service Director Jameson and FBI Director Lawler. Is it or is it not true that Agent Harvath disrupted and possibly contaminated three separate crime scenes and assaulted a federal officer?
For some reason, probably his intense dislike for the Chief of Staff, Lawler changed his earlier stance and chose to come to Scott's defense.
We're looking into it.
Looking into it? From what I hear, it was you that had him recalled for it.
Dafina's feigned anger was growing with each passing second, as was his satisfaction. He knew he had them on the ropes, and he grabbed at the opportunity to regain the control Vale had taken from him.
Director Jameson, why hasn't this man been placed on leave until a full-scale investigation can be conducted?
I have yet to fully debrief him. This is a Secret Service matter and will be handled as such. I hardly think we need the Vice President's Chief of Staff telling us how to do our jobs.
Well, obviously somebody should.
Just like somebody told you it was okay to answer the President's secure line, fired Harvath.
Embarrassed, but not letting on, Dafina continued.
Director Jameson, like it or not, Vice President Marshfield is in charge, and may be for quite some time. If, and I stress the if, the President does not return safely, the Vice President will finish out his term. I need not remind you that your position as Director of the Secret Service has already been severely jeopardized. If, and I am stressing the if again, the President does not return to his office, you will retain your directorship only by the consent of Vice President Marshfield. Do I make myself clear?
Jameson was up against it. As much as he hated to admit it, Dafina was right. Before he could respond, though, Dafina continued his attempt to roll over him.
I want this man, he said, pointing at Harvath, suspended immediately, pending a full investigation. I don't want to see him near the White House or anywhere else for that matter. Am I clear?
I'll take it under advisement. In the meantime, I want to make sure you are completely clear on something. Short of a horrific constitutional crisis that would put you in the Oval Office, I am still the Director of the Secret Service. I don't take orders from you.
Got me?
Asked Jameson.
Director Jameson, I warn you that you are walking a very, very fine line. I can assure you that when I speak, I am speaking for the Vice President, who, per the Cabinet's invoking of the 25th Amendment, is now acting President and Commander-in-Chief. Agent Harvath is to be suspended, period. Understood?
Harvath knew he had nothing to lose and decided he wasn't going to let this pipsqueak get the last word.
You've got more to worry about than me, you know.
You just won't disappear, will you? Of course we have more to worry about than just you, replied Dafina.
A lot more. First, you've got a leak somewhere. Someone with some pretty substantial access. Those kidnappers had help, high-level help. And then?
Against his better judgment, Lawler tried to save him.
Scott, shut it. Agent Lawler, with all due respect, I'm going to listen to what Agent Harvath has to say because I guarantee you these will be the last words he ever utters in his capacity as an active Secret Service agent. So, continued Dafina, as he made his way around the table so he could stand right above Harvath, what else do you have to say? You couldn't possibly dig your grave any deeper than you already have. Or could you?
Standing above him was an obvious power play meant to intimidate. But Scott Harvath wasn't easily intimidated. In fact, the move pissed him off. He wasn't an idiot, and he'd been trying to couch what he was planning to say as diplomatically as possible. But his anger was building and quickly getting the better of him. He fought hard to keep it under control. Harvath had swiveled his chair to the right as Dafina approached and leaned slightly back, assuming a relaxed, non-threatened posture.
Mr. Dafina.
That's Chief of Staff Dafina to you, Harvath. Get it right. You know, it's all starting to become clear to me how this whole thing happened. Some of the people around here might be impressed with your SEAL background, but it doesn't impress me. You fucked up big time as the advance man. The whole Secret Service fucked up, and I don't give a rat's ass that you saved the President's daughter. The President is gone, and I don't need to go looking far and wide for somewhere to lay the blame. It's sitting right here in front of me.
Dafina punctuated his next remark by poking Harvath in the shoulder with his pudgy finger.
So, if you've got something to say, then say it, because your career is finished.
Harvath snapped. Grabbing Dafina's finger, he stood up from the chair and gave the finger a good twist, making Dafina's arm go limp, and then bent it behind him.
He raised Defina's hand upward toward the back of his neck and leaned forward to speak into his ear.
Yeah, I've got something to say. First, your mother should have taught you not to point at people, especially a seal. There's nothing that pisses me off more than when people point at me. It's not very polite. Second, you and your boss are playing a very deadly game. His no negotiating with terrorists line doesn't fool anyone, especially me. You know what?
Defina winced in pain. Harvath continued.
Your little call to the Syrians didn't fool me either. It was plain to everybody in this room. Your boss is going to milk this thing for all it's worth. And if the president isn't returned alive, he'll have a 100% approval rating when he bombs whomever you guys finger as the ones responsible. There's nothing the American people like more than an all-out bombing run. Having accomplished that, your boy will be a shoo-in for president in the next election. This whole thing stinks.
Scott let Defina go and turned to walk toward the door. As he did, he noticed the chief of staff cock his arm back with an open hand as if he intended to slap him. Spinning, Scott just missed Defina's blow and brought his fist up in an uppercut to the man's jaw. With a crack, the punch landed, and blood spurted from Defina's mouth as his teeth clamped together, catching part of his lip. Immediately, Defina's hands flew to his face as he staggered backward. Jameson waited a beat, and then fished out a handkerchief and handed it to him. When Defina saw the blood, his rage was for real.
Harbath, if you had even a prayer of surviving before, it's gone now. You are through.
Turning to the group, Defina said,
Do you see what he did to me?
This time, it was the normally quiet and reserved FBI director Source who spoke first.
Yeah, I saw it clear as day. You tried to strike Agent Harvath when he wasn't looking, and he turned just in time. Looked to me like he was raising his hand to protect himself and your chin got in the way. Simple case of self-defense. As I'm sure everyone in the room will agree.
Self-defense? Self-defense? That's bullshit, and you know it. What about when he grabbed my finger and twisted my arm behind my back?
To tell you the truth, I didn't see that, but poking Agent Harvath is technically assault, and anything he did would have been in self-defense.
A very pissed-off Defina glowered at the other men and said,
And I suppose you all agree with Director Source?
No one said anything. They just sat, stone-faced.
All in all, continued Source, your conduct is very unbecoming for a chief of staff, even a vice presidential one. I'd hate to think what the media would do with this if it got out.
Look at my lip. I can feel it beginning to swell. What am I going to say to people?
Well, you can say what we used to say back in Chicago. When a suspect got a little roughed up, you slipped.
Defina gathered his folder, and when he was a safe distance away and had his hand on the doorknob, he spat,
This is not over, Harvath. You are going down. I promise you.
34. There was no telling how long he had been lying on the cold concrete floor of Senator Snyder's basement. What he did know was that he ached all over and couldn't stop shivering from the waves of cold that tortured his naked body. Andre had always considered himself to be in very good shape. Being a junior associate DC lawyer who specialized in international finance didn't exactly require a hard body, but being in superlative health had always been his choice. To balance his regime of weightlifting and cardiovascular exercise, and also to give his mind something positive to focus on during the bleak DC winters, he had taken up yoga 2 years ago. It was a nice way to get his heart rate up when he couldn't get to the club, or it was too dreadful outside to run. He'd never had any idea that it would one day save his life. The hogtie position Snyder had left him in would have immobilized most, but not Andre. From the beginning, his focus had been on controlling his mind and his breathing, trying not to let fear overtake him. The cords around his ankles and wrists tore into his skin, but he put the pain out of his mind and tried to focus on staying calm. The rag stuffed in his mouth
threatened to gag him with every breath. But he knew, on a logical as well as very primal level, that he couldn't give in to the urge to vomit. With his arms drawn so tightly behind his back, any movement hurt. After struggling against his bonds several times, only to have his mind race uncontrollably ahead to what lay in store for him when the senator returned, Andre lay still. He assessed the situation.